This is the sixth day of this April 2012 7-day session, and we'll just take one more day on the teachings of Muso Kokushi, national teacher Muso Soseki. This is from a book called Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. Essential Zen meditation is not just a matter of controlling thoughts and keeping the body immobile. So we can't say that it is important to sit facing a wall and stop thinking. Also, it is not a matter of contemplating doctrinal principles, so we can't say it is important to learn doctrinal principles. It does not require wealth, so we can't say we are too poor to do it. It does not require physical strength, so we can't say we are too weak to do it. It does not claim there is no Buddhism within worldly passions, so we can't say that it is inaccessible to ordinary people. He's quite methodically here stripping excuses from people who might want to find a reason not to enter this practice. The first one maybe is the most important. It's not just a matter of controlling thoughts and keeping the body immobile. So we can't say it is important to sit facing a wall and stop thinking. Well, he's speaking that from the ultimate perspective is that Zen practice goes far beyond sitting. Far, far, far beyond sitting. Zen practice is a practice we want to maintain through all of our waking hours. It means keeping the mind present and refraining from getting lost in thoughts all the time. But the time when we have the best shot of doing that successfully, the time when it's easiest is our sitting in one of these postures. The limbs are collected into the center of the body and back is straight. The eyes are closed somewhat halfway. And certainly we can't say that Zen meditation is, we're not trying to control our thoughts. We don't want to do anything with our thoughts, not even control them, just leave them alone. And then this last one, it doesn't claim there is no Buddhism within worldly passions. That's another one that I think people can sometimes imagine. Oh, look at me with all my anger and sexual cravings and jealousy and envy and so forth. How can I do this? Well, you can. It's just a matter of trusting in the root practice, the breath or the koan. And those passions, those we could say blind passions, are very much sustained through our thoughts. And when we allow the thoughts to settle and we have nothing to do with them, then those passions, they may surge now and then, but if we're not binding them to us through thoughts, then like any little storm, they pass. In fact, I would say that people without passion don't have any advantage over people with passions. The passions can be harnessed. They provide fuel for real serious practice. People without passions to speak of can be very cerebral and are very susceptible to intellectualizing, which has its own handicap. Here's a short one. To make critical studies and judgments of the differences in the utterances of enlightened people is mundane vanity and idle sophistry. This arises from ignorance of the real nature and purpose of Zen sayings. Now, these utterances or sayings he's referring to, I believe, are koans. So let's plug that word koans in here. To make critical studies and judgments of the differences in the koans of the enlightened people is mundane vanity and idle sophistry, and yet it's gaining strength in American Zen, especially on the West Coast, but maybe elsewhere, where they're forming more Zen centers are having koan circles. These are centers where koans are not worked on in the way we work on them. They're not worked on the traditional way with teachers who have passed koans. They become topics of literary discussion. This is a very troubling development. It wouldn't be so bad if the people who engaged in these discussions would always, whenever they referred to a koan that they have, quote, worked on, if they would specifically say, now this, you know, this wasn't in Doksan, this is just in one of these discussion groups, so like book groups. But they don't. They fudge it. They see this in the Zen teachers' meetings where these teachers will refer to having worked on such a koan, or having giving the impression that one has really resolved it in a non-intellectual way. Here's another topic. Zen teachers may speak of wondering about Zen koans. What he's translating as wondering could also be translated as questioning. But I do like that translation, wondering. That's what it really means when you're questioning a koan, is you're wondering. So I'll just stick with his translation, but we know it means questioning as well. Zen teachers may speak of wondering about Zen koans, or they may speak of not wondering about them. There is no fixed track for Zen teachers to follow. Sometimes Zen teachers tell students to look at koans questioningly. Sometimes they tell them not to doubt. Doubt meaning question. In every case, a teacher is dealing directly with a student, not speaking in generalities. Zen teachings are not doctrines kept in mind by the teachers. They are produced spontaneously at the interface between teacher and student. One should not try to freeze momentary teachings into fixed theories. This, by the way, is why I, like Roshi Kaplow and his teachers, I feel strongly that students should not mention to other students what goes on in Doksan, because it can be what was appropriate and maybe helpful for one student could be not at all for another student, and then it can set up confusion in the mind of the person who's hearing about the other person's Doksan. He goes on, if Zen teachers are enlightened, their teaching may effectively take any form. If they are not enlightened, whatever form their teaching may take, it will actually blind their students. This is a real important principle, that there's no teaching as an abstraction in itself. The teaching is what emerges between teacher and student, either individually or in a group, like this. What I say now to this group in Taisho, I might not say to in another sesshin. That's what makes it alive. Later in this book, he says the same thing in little different words. It's short, so let me... He says, in the Sutra on Settling Doubts About Imitation Teaching, who's heard of that one? It says, literalism is the enemy of the Buddhas of past, present, and future. And then Musso comments, genuine teachers with clear eyes do not have prepackaged dogmas stored up in their chests. They just speak out according to the potential of the situation without any fixed slogans. This is why in Zen the emphasis is not on the words, but on the spirit behind the words. You can say one thing in one instance, and then another time you could say something that's the opposite in words. And they both, there's no contradiction if they come out of the mind of understanding. We see this in the Mumonkan, where a monk asked Basso one time, what is Buddha? Which is just a standard way at the time of asking what is the highest truth, what is ultimate reality. And Basso said, this very mind is Buddha. And then another one in the Mumonkan, same question, Basso says, not mind, not Buddha. What's beyond all these words and concepts? That's what Basso is pointing to. He goes on, Musso goes on, when people ask about Zen, masters may reply with sayings of Confucius or Mencius. These were Confucian great sages, or Lao Tzu, or Zhuangzi, these are the Taoist sages of the time, or sometimes they may reply with teachings of the doctrinal schools of Buddhism. Sometimes they use proverbs to answer. Sometimes they use objects at hand. The methods of masters are called the living play of Zen. They cannot be judged by the feelings and perceptions of those who have not reached this state. Sometimes they use objects at hand. In one Zen book somewhere, they talk about this Chinese master who would, when asked about Zen, he would pull out a little toy lion and answer with that somehow. We don't know. What is Buddha? Oh, here. This very mind is Buddha. Here's an interesting one. People meditating on the fundamental okay, doing zazen, carry out their ordinary tasks and activities in the midst of meditation, and carry out meditation in the midst of ordinary tasks and activities. Okay, we were just talking about that. There is no disparity between meditation and activity. It is for those as yet incapable of this, who those weak in focusing their intent on the way, that special meditation periods were set up. The practice of meditating four times a day in Zen communities began in this manner during the 12th century. This left me scratching my head a little. He seems to be saying that before the 12th century, there weren't the four meditation blocks a day that that we have here in Sesshin. But surely they had monks sitting together, maybe just not with that kind of a regular schedule. Now, personally, even though I've been doing this so long, I would never want to do without it. It's nothing like sitting. Yeah. That having been said, we constantly want to work on bringing this mind of meditation into all of our activities, but that itself is extremely difficult, especially for newer people, very difficult without the sitting part. And then he goes on in the same line. In ancient times, Zen monks meditated 24 hours a day. Of course, he's talking about not sitting, but this other. In later times, however, there were those who became monks to avoid the trouble of making a living in the ordinary world. Their appetites distracted them from Buddhism, and when they participated in rituals, their attention was taken away from the fundamental. Since these and other things inhibited them from work on the fundamental, they would have wasted their lives had not some other expedient been devised. This expedient was the rule of four daily periods of sitting meditation. People who really have their minds on the way, in contrast, don't forget work on the fundamental, no matter what they are doing. Yet, if they still distinguish this work from ordinary activities, even as they do them together, they will naturally be concerned about being distracted by activities and forgetting the meditation work. This is because of viewing things as outside the mind. That's the false distinction we make if we think of practice as just happening when we're sitting and everything else is another animal. It's all attending to the mind. It's noticing. It's awareness. Whether we're sitting without moving, or we're stirring the soup, or we're vacuuming the floor, or scrubbing a bathroom, it's all awareness. That's what it all comes down to. That's practice. When we're sitting facing a wall and not moving, then we have less to divert our awareness, to fragment our awareness. And so that is especially concentrated. But even when we're very active, we want to bring this kind of awareness. And awareness is something other than being lost in thoughts. This is plenty hard outside of Sesshin, and even in the early part of Sesshin, it can be plenty hard. But now, in this later stage, we can really get a sense of what this means. We can keep this practice of awareness, continuous, more or less. And then we come to understand that that a big reason why we can't make it continuous in our daily lives is because we don't do much sitting, most people. An ancient master said, "Mountains, rivers, the whole earth, the entire array of phenomena are all oneself." And then Musso says, "If you can absorb the essence of this message, there are no activities outside of meditation. You dress in meditation and eat in meditation. You walk, stand, sit, and lie down in meditation. You perceive and think in meditation. You experience joy, anger, sadness, and happiness in meditation." Means when you're feeling joy, you're aware that you're feeling joy. When you're angry, you're aware of the anger. It's extremely important. When you're sad, you're aware of sadness. When you're happy, you're aware that you're happy. You're not just swept up in the emotion or the thought. He goes on, "If it is granted that there is no distinction between meditation and ordinary activities, then it appears then it appears contradictory for Zen and other schools of Buddhism to urge students to let go of things and be aloof from objects." And then he develops this. "An ancient master said, the teaching has no fixed form. Whatever you encounter is the source." And then Musso comments, "The methods of teaching used by the wise to guide learners have no fixed form or appearance. Since it is a general principle of all universalistic Buddhist schools that there is no discrepancy between the Dharma and worldly phenomena, no genuine teachers could say there is practice of the Dharma outside of events and activities." So, in other words, anything is a practice place. Ultimately, in the broadest sense. So, working out at one's fitness club is a zendo. Make it a zendo. A restaurant, make it a zendo. But then, here's the other side. "Nevertheless, because people who do not understand this entertain false ideas about things of the world, Zen teachers expediently tell them to relinquish things temporarily so as to be, as to enable them to get rid of their fixations." So, in its essence, a bar is no less a practice place than a zendo, essentially. But he's saying we need to relinquish things that, in practical terms, are very difficult to practice in. I would say in the same line, there's good reason to relinquish time sitting idly in front of a computer screen. There are times, of course, when we need to use computers, but it can be such a temptation to take our minds away from this right here. Here's Here's another point Musso makes about renunciation or relinquishment. The father of the Buddha was a king. After his son attained Buddhahood and had begun to attract followers, the king had 500 members of his clan become monks and nuns. These numbers are always good, round, even numbers, you notice. Hearing the Buddha tell his followers not to adorn their clothing or their dwelling places, this is the Buddha telling his monks, one of these monks realized he could not follow the teaching. He didn't realize, he thought he could not follow the teaching because as a member of a royal clan, he was used to luxury. So in response to this, when the Buddha got wind of this, he told a senior disciple to go to the royal palace and get all sorts of finery to decorate a place for this monk. And he had the monk stay there for the night. Because the monk's usual cravings for luxury had been fulfilled, the monk's rambling thoughts spontaneously stopped and clarity of knowledge emerged. In the last part of the night, he came to awakening. The senior disciple was amazed by all of this and asked the Buddha about it. The Buddha said, "There are those whose attention to the way is fostered by adorning their clothes and houses. For them, such adornment is an aid to enlightenment. Then again, there are those whose attention to the way is diminished by fancy clothing and furnishings. These people should therefore beware of such things. Realization of the way and attainment of its fruits depend entirely on the mentality of the practitioner, with no necessary relationship to such things as clothing and dwelling places. So, for certain people, finery should not be prohibited as a hindrance to practice of the way. But when people whose minds are not really on the way of enlightenment use such examples to claim that indulgence in luxury is no hindrance to enlightenment, they are deluded." Here I think of, we began this Teisho with Musso talking about how you don't need this to practice the way, you don't need that, as a way of removing excuse making from people. Well, another excuse that I hear sometimes is people who say, "Oh, I'm really attached to things. I've got to have my this or that." Have it, but sit. You can sit. I now say this at workshops, every workshop, because I know that there are people there who see it as a steep practice and who misunderstand it as something austere and monastic, which of course it can be, but wherever we find ourselves, we can find time to collect ourselves each day, sit with a straight back, and look into the mind. It doesn't matter what kind of circumstances you're in, wealthy or poor. So this shows the flexibility, the skillful means of the Buddha in providing these luxurious things for this monk to free him up, to get beyond these secondary things, these relatively superficial things. Roshi Kaplow would sometimes grant people certain exceptions to rules and let them do things that others couldn't. And he once said, "Sometimes you have to give someone what he wants so that he'll want what you have to give him." is another topic entirely. In China, now this is when Chan, that is Chinese Zen, was just getting making its transition into Japan. So there's a lot of interest and a lot of cross-cultural engagements. And Musso here says, in China, tea is drunk for health. Just as an overdose of medicine causes trouble, tea should not be taken to excess. Now, here, what we can do, what I would invite everyone to do, is plug in, instead of tea, think of coffee. It's more, brings it home. In ancient times, tea was valued as a stimulant to banish drowsiness and help people study. Study. Ah, drives me crazy when they translate practice as study. And help people practice. The founder of Zen in Japan also liked tea for its stimulating effect to help people practice the way. Later on, however, the use of tea for health purposes or for practice gave way to frivolous overuse. This also created extra expense and led to neglect of the Dharma. The liking for tea may itself be one and the same, therefore, but whether it is beneficial or harmful depends on the attitude of the individual. In other words, whether it becomes an attachment. Same with anything. The internet, electronic devices, it's in the measure of it's how it's used. Food. This principle also applies to the arts. Once they become objects of personal attachment, however, their refining action is lost and they turn into occasions for perversion and corruption. Roshi Kaplow was a great art collector in his younger days, and we still benefit from some of those wonderful prints, pictures that he got in Japan, before Japan. But I once heard him say, he's just talking about collecting art and other things, and he said collectors are nothing if not greedy. He had, by that point, he had stopped buying so much. He'd seen that it had become an attachment. It is for this reason that Buddhist teachers sometimes say that there is no way to meditate outside of life's activities, and sometimes they encourage people to set activities aside in order to meditate. An ancient said, it is always there, right where you are. If you seek it, obviously you do not see it. And then Musso comments, the fundamental ground, that's what this ancient was referring to, of course, is not inside the body and mind, nor is it outside the body and mind, nor can it be said that the total body-mind is the fundamental ground. It is not in the categories of sentience or insentience. It is not the knowledge of Buddhas and saints. The knowledge of Buddhas and saints, as well as the bodies and minds of sentient beings and even their worlds and lands, all come from this. That is why it is provisionally called the fundamental ground. The Diamond Sutra says, the Buddhas and the Buddha's teaching of supreme perfect enlightenment all come from this sutra. And then Musso says, this adamantine insight is the fundamental ground. And we all stand upon this ground. We sit upon this ground. This ground is what joins us. It's the sky behind the clouds. It can't come and go. It's the very ground, the sky ground. This is mind. This is Buddha nature. And he quotes another sutra, the Complete Enlightenment Sutra. All pure suchness, enlightenment, nirvana, and the transcendent ways flow forth from complete awareness. And then Musso says, this complete awareness is the fundamental ground. Awareness, might say, is the ground also that connects all forms of meditation. It would seem, not that I've practiced them all, but what could it be if not awareness? What can we accomplish? What can we know or practice without awareness? It all comes down to awareness. Awareness of the mind, what's going on in the mind, when, to what we're paying attention at every moment. Since the fundamental ground, he says, is neither a feature of the world nor a transmundane phenomenon, many people who want to practice Zen wonder how it can be reached. This question itself, however, indicates a failure to understand the implications of the term fundamental. Once you have heard of what is neither a mundane nor a transmundane thing, you are foolish to wonder how to reach it. To reach the fundamental ground is not something like going from the country to the city or from one land to another. In reality, it is like waking up from a dream. All the questions about where the fundamental ground is and how to get there are part of the dream, arising from the thoughts of a dream about a dream. So again and again, we're returned to the same point that so long as we are discriminating at all about between here and there, between delusion and enlightenment, between right and wrong and this and that, so long as we're doing that, we are missing this fundamental ground. It is only by suspending all activity of the mind in our sitting that we can then come to rest in this fundamental ground. As soon as we have the faintest flicker of a thought about how to get something, get somewhere, we've gone astray. Well, this is a good place to stop, so we'll recite the four vows.